Thursday, August 10th. Welcome on in to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I am Cherry Gregg. Avi, are you a fan of Jeopardy?
I am. I don't want to overstate my credentials. I'm not like an appointment viewer of Jeopardy. It's not on every night at 7, yeah. But I've been watching the show on and off for years and years and years.
Yeah, me too. And today, for all our Jeopardy fans, we have host and Jeopardy champion Ken Jennings coming up a little later this
hour.
That is exciting.
It really is.
And we'll talk to him about the show, of course, but also the afterlife. He has a fun, quirky new book out. It's titled 100 Places to See After You Die, a travel guide to the afterlife.
We have an interesting job. Never thought I would be talking to Ken Jennings about what happens after I die, but we're going to do it coming up on Studio 2. And of course, we and the producers could not resist making Ken Jennings our weekly Studio 2 trivia contestant this hour. This is history right now.
And you're leveling up your quiz master persona. I cannot wait witness this.
I'm going to ask Ken Jennings a trivia question. If he gets it right, he gets a Studio 2 grocery tote bag.
He's just like everybody else.
This is the biggest moment in the history of trivia, as far as I'm concerned. But first, before we get to all that, Cherry, huge night for the Philadelphia Phillies last night. And how could you not love baseball?
Mm-hmm.
So many games, and they all, or most of them, fade into dust immediately. You can't remember one that happened, you know, 3 days ago, because they all seem so similar. And then you turn on your TV in the fifth inning on a Wednesday in August, and you realize something strange is happening. This guy pitching for the Phillies right now, Michael Lorenzen, he hasn't let up a hit yet. And he hasn't let up a hit yet into the sixth and the seventh and the eighth and the ninth. And then there's two outs in the ninth. And then you hear this call from Tom McCarthy.
Swung on, popped up, shallow center field. Rojas sprinting in. He's under it. He has space. Makes the catch. And Michael Lorenzen has thrown the 14th no-hitter in Philadelphia Phillies history. He is being mobbed by his teammates as the Phillies shut out the Nationals 7-0.
Chills.
Even I knew that this was a big deal, and
it's
to cheer.
14 no-hitters in franchise history. The Phillies have played 21,324 games. Only 14 no-hitters. So we had to take a moment, pause, talk about all of this with John Stolness, host of the WHYY Billy Penn podcast, Hittin' Season. That's a podcast all about the Phillies. John, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a fun day to talk some Phils.
Absolutely. Tell me about where you were last night watching this game and your emotions watching it.
Well, I live in the D.C. area, as a lot of you guys know. So, of course, they're playing the Nationals, and my son is a big Nationals fan. So we were kind of keeping track of it as we were doing other things. And by the time the seventh inning rolled around, we put it on the TV, and we were just watching it here at home. And, of course, he's hoping that somebody on the Nationals is going to break through and get a hit, while I'm at the same time not so low-key rooting for him to, for him to just kind of keep mowing through the Nationals lineup.
Yeah, I got to ask you this, because for folks who may not know why this is so special, Avi laid out some stats on this, but, you know, folks were crying in the stands. Just explain why this is such a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, these don't happen every day, especially for the Phillies. From my memory, I think this is only maybe the third no-hitter ever to happen at home. I know Terry Mulholland threw one in 1990. There was Roy Halladay's no-hitter in the playoffs in 2010. And this one, I think every other no-hitter has been on the road. So we don't get to see this a whole lot here in Philadelphia. It's been a hot minute since 2015 when Cole Hamels threw his. We haven't seen one at home, like we said, since Halladay's. And so I think a lot of the tears you saw were from the family members who were in attendance. I mean, you had Michael Lorenzen's mother, and you had his wife with their nine-month-old baby in the stands watching his first ever game in Philadelphia in front of the fans of Citizens Bank Park. And it looked like to me that they might take him out after the seventh inning. His pitch count had gotten really high, and he really needed to be efficient to get through the last two innings and be allowed to stay in the game. It wasn't a sure thing that he was going to be allowed to stay in there and finish it. So when he did, it was kind of just an emotional release for everybody.
Adding to the drama of it all. And as you mentioned, John, the last Phillies pitcher before this to throw a no-hitter was Cole Hamels, who was a legendary pitcher for the team. He was making what turned out to be his final start as a Philly, and it was this valedictory moment for him as a Philly. And this is the flip side, right? Michael Lorenzen, I mean, a lot of Phillies fans don't even really know who he is. So who is Michael Lorenzen? He just joined the team.
Yeah, he's been in the big leagues for about 9 or 10 years. He was with the Reds for a long time as a relief pitcher. He was actually better known as a really, really good hitting pitcher. He actually played some center field for the Reds when he wasn't in the bullpen. So he's actually got a really good bat. This year, the Phillies picked him up at midseason at the trade deadline from the Detroit Tigers. He was an all-star with Detroit this year. Funny story, when he was told that he was going to the All-Star game, he thought his manager was kidding with him because at the time he had an ERA in the mid-fours, and he didn't think he had pitched well enough to be an All-Star. So he went, and since then he has an ERA just above one. He's really come on over the last 6 or 7 starts, and he's just a journeyman who's been plugging away for years and years and years, and this is his first real opportunity this season to be an everyday major league starter, and he's really taking advantage of it.
Wow.
Yeah, I got to ask you, you kind of mentioned some of the limitations on the pitcher in your discussion about the significance of this no-hitter. And we had you on the show before talking about some of the changes to the game of baseball. How's that going? And, you know, just generally, I was able to go see a game on Tuesday.
Missed it by one day.
I know, they did. They didn't win. They didn't even win. But then for it to turn around and get this no-hitter the next day, amazing. Yeah. Just how is it all going? Is the game doing what it was supposed to do?
I'm sorry to hear you missed a home
no-hitter.
You just reminded me of a no-hitter in 2003 that Kevin Millwood threw at Veterans Stadium.
Right.
So there's another home no-hitter. And I was supposed to go to that game and had to miss out on it. So
you know how
I'm going to make both of you jealous. I was at the Roy Halladay postseason no-hitter, which was the last one at home.
I was there.
But we got to get back on track quickly,
yeah.
John. The changes to speed up the game, how have you been enjoying them, and are they working overall?
It is working. It's shaved off a half an hour from game time, and it's all dead time. There are no fewer pitches being thrown. I mean, you're getting just as much offense. The game is just moving quicker. There's less dead time between pitches. And I don't know that the clock has had an effect on whether or not some pitchers have struggled with it. I think Aaron Nola is one who has. Others haven't. For Lorenzen, maybe the having to continue to pitch quickly just kind of kept him in his zone, kept him in rhythm. There's also a possibility for some pitchers that it doesn't allow them enough time to rest between pitches and to gather their thoughts. It really is just dependent on how the pitcher operates. But it's been good. I think it's been a really healthy change.
And real quick before we let you go, John, Weston Wilson was called up to the Phillies, played his first game last night. This was overshadowed. Hit a home run in his first at bat, and I believe still has not recorded an out in his major league career. Who is this guy, and what's been his journey to this moment? Because it was a great moment for him and his family.
Yeah, he's had nearly 3,000 plate appearances in the minor leagues over the course of 7 seasons without ever getting a chance to hit at the major leagues. And he's obviously getting a chance because Brandon Marsh got hurt. They put him in left field last night, and he hit a shot to deep left center field. And his dad's in the stands. His whole family is in the stands, just like Lorenzen. His dad's crying after the home run. It was such an emotional night at the ballpark last night because you have this kid who has just been struggling for years and years and years and years to finally get his one shot, his first chance to be in the major leagues, and on his first plate appearance, his second swing ever as a big league hitter, he hits a 435 foot home run to left center field. It's storybook, and there's so many stories like this throughout major league history. This is one that has a Phillies flavor to it, and it's so much fun.
Baseball is magic.
I know, and we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much. That's John Solness, host of WHYY Billy Penn's Hitting Season podcast. Great to have you on Studio 2, John.
Thanks for having me.
You can find Hitting Season wherever you get your podcasts or stream it at billypenn.com/hittingseason. And
speaking of seasons.
Speaking of seasons, it's the summer season. And, you know, this is a time when most people are headed down the Jersey Shore. But Avi, some rental homes, they have been staying
empty
this season. Why? Well, the high prices and people have options.
Yes.
Yeah. So during the pandemic, if you recall, many families chose a trip to the shore because they couldn't go to Europe because of those travel restrictions. And so investors bought property to make money off that tourism boom. And others realized they could get any price that they wanted. I mean, some of these houses were going for 10 grand for a week. Well, apparently, you know, now that things opened up, folks decided, you know what? I'm not paying 10 grand for a house on the shore. I'm going to take my family to Europe.
Yeah.
Great reporting from Amy Rosenberg at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I mean, and now, of course, the prices are coming down to pre-pandemic prices.
We had a show about how expensive the Jersey Shore was getting, and we talked a lot about the reasons, mm-hmm. but in the near terms, it seemed like all we really needed was a market correction and people to have all the old options, like you said, their travel mm-hmm. options available to them. And now that they do, the Jersey Shore doesn't quite have the market cornered as it once did.
I'm like, 10 grand for the shore? Okay, y'all. They were bugging out. Yeah, I'm sorry, but it was a lot. But I will say
people.
That. But now the prices are going down in some cases from $10,000 a week to $5,000.
Speaking of travel, let's talk about traveling artwork now. The Barnes Foundation. Okay, so before I say anything about the Barnes Foundation, you got to do a lot of backstory because that's how this thing works. Barnes Foundation. Albert C. Barnes collected a whole bunch of art, kept it in a very unusual place out on the main line for a long, long time, put it in his will, don't move the art, keep it there. It's arranged the way I wanted it. Eventually, after a lot of legal wrangling, they take the collection, kind of override his will, move it down to a beautiful building on the Parkway. That's where the Barnes Foundation art collection is now. Now they are further loosening some of the restrictions on how the art can be used, and they are, for the first time, thanks to a new court decision, going to be able to do some loaning of artwork to other institutions in the collection. Because remember, Barnes didn't want any of this stuff moved or touched.
No.
He didn't even want you to move it from one room to the other. Mm-hmm. Now it could be traveling across oceans. So that is just in, and it's another sign that the Barnes collection is becoming more and more, and I say this with no judgment, becoming more and more like every other museum.
And it's a good thing. I mean, they get to make money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if they loan, it's a financial benefit to the institution. It also gets to share some of the value of the Barnes. But they're, like you said, it's very restrictive. Only 20 paintings should be on loan simultaneously.
Right.
And they had a sort of bad situation in the 90s where one of the paintings got damaged. And so folks are a little wary. But the judge is trying to, balance everything while, sharing some of the wealth and some of the educational, opportunities here.
I mean,
abide by Barnes's original wishes at the same time.
You think about the history of the institution. It started as something that was sort of completely singular in the art world. And now it's drifting, closer and closer to the norm. And one of the reasons, I believe, that museums swap paintings this way is because, look, if you have the same collection there every day of the week,
why would
people keep going back? And so they have special exhibits and they move stuff around the world in order to juice interest and keep these institutions viable. And, we'll see if it helps the Barnes. But like you said, it's limited still.
Yeah. And speaking of viability,
Philadelphia's
Republican Party. Yes. They are trying to stay viable here in Philadelphia by getting the Working Families Party off the ballot. They are trying to end Philadelphia City Council member Kendra Brooks's bid for a second term in City Council and to remove the party from the at-large, to remove the party from the ballot, also from her running mate, Nicholas O'Rourke.
Yeah.
And this would shift everything for the November ballot. And if you recall, Kendra Brooks, she upset a Republican, becoming the first Working Families Party member to win against a Republican.
And just as a reminder for folks, the way City Council works here in Philadelphia, the at-large seats, two of them have to go to someone who is not in the majority party, which in Philadelphia means not a Democrat. And so the Republicans are trying to basically erase their main competition for those two seats by using this technicality to get the two Working Families Party's members thrown off the ballot. And what I thought when I saw this was, okay, if it works, maybe a successful short-term strategy. But if you're trying to maintain your relevance in a city,
doesn't work.
And you do that by taking choices away from voters, you got to imagine that's going to inspire some long-term ire. So I don't know. This could be short-term benefit, long-term not so much.
I will mention quickly that GOP members in New York also tried to take out the Working Family Party there by changing their party affiliation to the Working Families Party to do a hijacking of the ballot. So there's this beef there.
All right. Well, that is it for our news roundup today. Coming up, Jeopardy host Ken Jennings talking to us about what happens in the afterlife. Stay tuned.
Put the load right on me. supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
After I died and the makeup had dried, I went back to my place. No moon that night, but a heavenly light shone on my face. Still, I thought it was odd. There was no sign of God just to usher me in.
Welcome back to Studio 2, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Most of us have wondered about what comes after death. Heaven, hell, or nothing? That question has inspired countless religious traditions, myths, books, movies, TV shows, and a whole lot more.
And you might be surprised to learn that Jeopardy host and champ Ken Jennings' new book focuses on how the afterlife is brought to life. From that song you just heard by Paul Simon, ancient Egyptian depictions of the underworld, Dante's Nine Circles of Hell, Field of Dreams, Beetlejuice, The Sixth Sense, on and on and on. The book is called 100 Places to See After You Die, a travel guide to the afterlife.
And Ken Jennings is with us now to take us on a tour. Ken Jennings, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And listeners, if you have a question for Ken, the email is studio2@whyy.org. And our phone number is 888-477-9499. Ken, I have to ask you, what inspired your curiosity about the afterlife and ultimately the desire to write this book in the form of a travel guide, no less?
Well, the book was an accident. I was at a bookstore a few years ago, and they had a table full of those bucket list books that have 1,000 of these to see and 1,000 of those to see. But they always say before you die. And it occurred to me they were leaving half of the market out. You know, why should all travel books be about what happens before you die? But the fact is, you know, I grew up a Gen X kid, and anybody my age will remember that that was a time when America was really fascinated with the paranormal. So my childhood was full of mysteries about UFOs and Bigfoot and ghosts. And we all thought the Bermuda Triangle was going to be a very big part of our lives back then for some reason. And growing up as one of those kids interested in the unexplained, death and what comes after always seemed like the biggest mystery to me. You know, it matters the most, and yet nobody knows. So I loved those kind of stories, ghost stories and near-death experiences and movies and TV shows that purported to show what might await us. It's just such a tantalizing thing. It's just there on the other side. Everybody we know will go through it. If there's something there, they know right now, but we don't. I loved that. I was always interested in that.
Do you have an earliest childhood memory of someone sitting you down and telling you, hey, this is what happens after you die? Is there like a foundational moment for you entering into that conversation in your mind?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is, I would go to Sunday school as a kid, but I don't come from a particularly fire and brimstone kind of tradition like an evangelical kid does. So I don't have the memories of a pastor or a nun scaring me with the afterlife, which I think is really formative for me, because instead I was just fascinated by it. You know, it would be an episode of a sitcom where, you know, somebody went to an afterlife with a lot of dry ice on the floor, or it would be a movie with a guardian angel gone awry, like It's a Wonderful Life, or it would be a Twilight Zone episode on rerunning on Sunday afternoon. You know, those were my glimpses of the afterlife. And I think that's why I'm just kind of delighted by the stories instead of traumatized by them.
Yeah, because death and the afterlife is such a heavy topic, especially in religious circles. I want you to kind of walk us through your process for curating this list of 100 destinations, because there's so many places and directions you can take this.
Well, I wanted to keep it light. And so the idea of structuring it as a travel guide really appealed to me, because there's a certain kind of voice in travel writing where you're telling people, here are my footsteps, here's what you should do. You want to feel confident, you know, that it's the ultimate undiscovered country. But if in a travel guide, you want to know, well, here's the best places to eat if I go to the Land of the Dead from the Pixar movie Coco, or here are the nicest places to stay in Dante's Inferno, or, you know, here are the real off the beaten path highlights in a Hieronymus Bosch painting, or John Milton's Paradise Lost. you know, you're kind of walking the viewer through the, or the reader through the afterlife in a comforting way. And that's what a lot of our traditions have. There's often guardian angels and orientations in different versions of the afterlife. And so the idea of the book is to provide some of that while we're alive. And I just wanted to cast a really wide net. So there's afterlives from video games, songs, Broadway musicals, paintings, theme park rides, comic strips, comic books. You know, it's everything from movies and TV all the way back to the oldest papyrus and scrolls.
And you keep it light. But of course, when you read through it, you start having some heavy thoughts. And in particular, for me, I kept seeing the parallels or the threads that tied together different versions of the afterlife. Like, for instance, there seemed like there were a few different versions where, like, you go somewhere really nice, but you can't stay there forever because we know in our minds that it's going to get boring eventually. And then you go somewhere else and you don't know where that is. Like, I felt so many people struggling with the concept of eternity when you described these places in various faith traditions and in various pop cultural depictions. Did you have any of those dark thoughts yourself?
Yeah, a lot of the older religious traditions have some sense of a purgatory. You know, if you're an Eastern Orthodox, you actually ascend through the air and you suffer for a different sin as you rise until, you know, then at that point you're saved in heaven. But you're right, there's the other problem. Modern depictions often include the discovery that there's no way to depict a perfect heaven because perfection is boring. And so there's a Talking Heads song about what if heaven is boring. It's a plot element on the sitcom The Good Place. For me, the darkest parts were some of the depictions of hell. There's an ancient Chinese version. You know, the tortures, of course, are very graphic and visceral. But there's a Chinese version of hell where after all the physical tortures are described, the very worst one of all is you get to go up and peek over a wall and see your hometown. And the torture is that you're seeing it now when you're gone and forgotten. Everyone's moved on. You know, your spouse is remarried. Your kids have forgotten you. Your inheritance has been squandered. No one thinks or talks about you anymore. You know, the ultimate punishment was being forgotten. And the Chinese knew that 3,000 years ago. That's chilling to me.
It's like a reverse Tom Sawyer type of situation. Where,
exactly.
Yeah. And it was weird. And I remember the Chinese one that you describe in the book. It's very bureaucratic, too, which was it seems a reflection of life. And so many of the paradises or the hells are reflections of, you know, society at that moment. Did you think about that when you were writing about some of the more modern depictions, like what prejudices, what rules, what types of thoughts are being reflected in these visions of paradise and hell?
Right. The book is really stealth sociology because you see what a culture values, you know, even the very old paradises, you know, if heaven is just a place with no crop failures, you're like, wow, these people were just terrified of crop failures. And that shaped all their thinking. You know, that was what determined if their kids might get through the winter. Whereas with more modern ones, you see what our fears are. The 20th century has brought with it lots of bureaucratic heavens, like the Chinese one, where there's always kind of a fussy angel with a clipboard and somebody's going through files. There's a lot of clerks. You know, for comic effect, the idea that heaven might be as mechanized as mid-century America. But that kind of reflects kind of maybe what we're worrying about those systems. Today, I see a lot of, a lot of streaming shows that have the afterlife. They have a lot of boredom in them, just kind of existential angst. Some of them have worries about technology. What if heaven is being uploaded to the cloud?
Right.
Worries about the gig economy, you know, people in heaven who still have to do terrible jobs like the TV show Dead Like Me. You know, the afterlife is really just an extension of what we think about the here and now.
And I just want to play a clip because one of my movies as a child I loved to watch was Beetlejuice. And in this 1988 classic, a young couple played by Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin, they die in a car accident and they're shocked and they're looking for answers.
Handbook for the recently diseased.
Deceased.
Deceased.
I don't know where it came from. Look at the publisher.
Handbook for the recently deceased press.
You know what? I don't think we survived the crash.
That always, I mean, they had to they had to enter this bureaucracy to get answers as they're stuck in purgatory. But I want to ask you this question, Ken, because did you find that that religions or cultural phenomenon focus more on the darker side of the afterlife versus the paradise side? Because it seemed like a lot of the stories talked about different versions of hell.
Yeah, the versions of hell are always way more painstakingly depicted. You know, a list of weird sins that will land you in hell, you know, whether for the Chinese that was littering, throwing pottery shards over your fence, borrowing a book and not returning it in Hinduism. You know, there's very specific problems. If you flirt with your son-in-law or your daughter-in-law, that's a very specific punishment in hell. And I think the detail must be, on some level, it's fear. You know, it's a system trying to keep people in line by saying, well, here's what happens if you throw pottery over the fence. But I think on another level, at some point, it moves beyond that. From the religious caste, it moves to artists. And it's just more fun to depict hell than heaven. Hell and purgatory at least have some sense of development. There's a comeuppance. If heaven is perfect every day, you know, there are really interesting heavens. Mark Twain wrote about a heaven where everyone chooses to be old rather than young, because it turns out that's the most comfortable, peaceful state of life. So there are discoveries in writings about heaven, but for whatever reason, hell gets all the, I guess hell has all the blood and gore.
Yeah. We are talking with Jeopardy host Ken Jennings about his latest book, 100 Places to See After You Die. You are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. If you want to join the conversation, drop us an email, studio2@whyy.org, or give us a call, 888-477-9499. You know, I grew up in the Jewish faith, Ken, and I went to religious school for years and years and years, and granted, maybe I wasn't paying the best attention, but I had never heard of, I don't even know how to pronounce, Gehenna and Gan Eden, which are respectively the hell and heaven described by some Jewish scholars. And I was sort of thinking to myself, why have I never really heard of these things? Why are they not emphasized? Did you feel yourself trying to explain, perhaps to yourself, not so much the readers, but to yourself, why certain faiths opted for different types of heavens and hells and why they emphasize them to various degrees?
Yeah, you know, I couldn't help but thinking a lot about that. I'm not a theologian or a professional religious scholar. I mean, notably, I'm a Gentile. From what I understand in the Jewish tradition, is there's a lot of emphasis on the here and now. You know, how do we make our lives better now? You know, what's the right way to live before God now? And so therefore, you know, you don't get these tales, but there are stories, you know, just different kinds of, a lot of them are medieval. You know, there's really nothing about Gehenna or Gan Eden in the Torah, but you know, a lot of these stories are medieval. They seem to accrete in religious traditions over the years, just new layers, because people are so curious. People ask, people wonder, mystics have visions. And so you get these very detailed stories that were really never part of the core religious faith at all, which is really interesting to me.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I was raised Catholic, and yet my family, they constantly talk to your ancestors, your grandmother and great grandfather. They're there with you fighting battles before you walk in the room. And I realized that is based in some of the African traditions. Yeah. And it wasn't part of my organized religion. And did you, as you did the research for this book, did you see a lot of mixing and matching as far as like what is considered part of pop culture? Like in the films, they're taking a little bit from this religion, a little bit from that culture, and mixing it all together.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the things that I think are generally believed about the Christian heaven and hell, for example, don't come from the Bible at all. They come from John Milton. They come from Paradise Lost. You know, we think we have this idea of who Lucifer is and how he fell and what Satan wants. And the Bible has almost nothing about that. There's like two verses about Lucifer in Isaiah. Everything else comes from a very long epic poem written, 1600 years later. So these traditions accumulate over time, and we don't always remember the origin. We just remember how they made us feel.
I was thinking about, you talk a lot in here about Dante, and there's, you know, Dante's mm-hmm. version of how there's like all sorts of Greek and Roman figures dancing around for some reason that way. It seemed like you were a little confused. I was a little confused too. I don't exactly know why, but I guess that's just the way these things work. They're all kind of amalgams.
Well, Dante's funny because he doesn't seem self-aware that he's not really that great a world builder. He goes to hell. And so, you know, there's presumably billions of suffering souls there. And the only people he ever meets are like really famous literary characters, you know, like Helen of Troy. And then he just meets his neighbors back home, and particularly his rivals from his time, who are now in hell suffering because he had a bone to pick against them. So this is the book that survives for centuries, is Dante kind of gloating because his political rivals from Renaissance era Florence are suffering in hell and he's not. It's kind of a funny small view of the world, but I guess when you look back far enough, that's what all these afterlives are. You know, Field of Dreams is one guy's very specific feelings about baseball. That's just how the internet, that's how the afterlife gets created.
Yeah. And if you just tuned in, we are speaking with Ken Jennings, Jeopardy host, author of a brand new book titled 100 Places to See After You Die. Ken, wondering where all this curiosity comes from, because, I mean, you're a very knowledgeable person. I mean, very successful Jeopardy contestant now, your host. And you seem to know a lot of information. Where did you get this original curiosity to learn so many things about so many different things?
You know, I've thought about that a lot over the years after being on a game show, of all things, changed my life. And luckily, I've been able to meet other people like me, you know, those weird trivia kids who were always carrying around the Guinness Book of World Records and annoying their teachers and their parents and their friends with facts about polar bears and the biggest omelet ever cooked, or, you know, whatever it was. And I think the thing all those people have in common is we're very curious. And a lot of people are curious, but trivia people are omnivorous about their curiosity. We're curious about everything. Most people just tend to specialize, like, well, yeah, I follow baseball, but not football. Or I really like jazz, but I don't follow pop. You know, people tend to carve out niches. Whereas for whatever reason, trivia people are curious about everything. You know, whatever the new thing is, it's like a shiny object. We're magpies, and we'll go down that rabbit hole. And the great blessing there is that when you're interested in a thing, you don't have to try to remember all the facts. You know, the stuff you love just sticks in your head, the lyrics to the song you like, or the names of the players on the team you follow. You know, those things just stick without even trying to. So if you could unlock that interest in your head, you would basically have a photographic memory. You'd remember everything. And I think trivia people are close to that. And I'm a believer in it. I think it's a great way to live.
I want to bring in an email here from Frank who says, points out that we haven't talked about reincarnation yet. What about reincarnation? Any insight on what's the best form to come back as? I suppose that's an opinion question for you, Ken, but I actually was surprised. Reincarnation appears in more traditions than I actually realized. And this book enlightened me to that. So let's talk a little bit about reincarnation. And I suppose, what would you like to come back as?
Yeah, a lot of modern afterlives have reincarnation because it's a convenient plot point. It's, you know, yes. It's an ending. Your character gets reborn as, you know, if the Hindus believed you could be a clump of grass or a bug. Generally in fiction, somebody's coming back as a baby. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's a tradition that you can actually choose your next life, that in the bardo, you can see different futures for yourselves kind of floating around you and gravitate towards the ones you like. You can actually see your parents in the act of conceiving you. It's not something I would want to see, but the Tibetans believed that. Yeah, to me, that would be hell. But for the Tibetans, that was the bardo. I don't know. I feel like I've been very happy and lucky in my current life. And maybe it would be good for me to have some good for the empathy of my karma to come back in a very different situation, you know, the other side of the world, not the privileges of being a white middle-class American, or maybe a golden retriever. I have a golden retriever and she seems to have a very happy, easy life. So that would be nice too.
Yeah. I saw that people could come back as grass. Like, you know, there's all different levels of reincarnation. I'm just fascinated at your trajectory because you grew up like, you know, loving Jeopardy, and then sort of like that you ended up writing quiz questions, editing quiz questions. how did you prepare like for a game? I know I'm fascinated with this Jeopardy situation just because I wonder how you prepared
to be a contestant.
Yeah. And then how that differs from preparing to be a host.
You know, I do feel very lucky. It's just such a bizarre thing that this was always my favorite show as a kid. And now, you know, 40 years later, I'm still identified with the show. It's such a bizarre treat, but, yeah, I mean, preparing for the show, you can't really cram for Jeopardy. You know, the host could ask you anything. It could be it could be about the Franco-Prussian War, and then suddenly it's going to be about country music or doing anagrams in your head. You know, there's really not a lot of ways to prepare. But I did watch the show religiously, and I think that really helped. You see the kinds of things that Jeopardy asks about all the time. Oh, it seems like I should know all my world capitals. I should know the presidents with their dates, so I know what happened when. You know, you can see the patterns. But I also just got really used to the rhythms of Alex Trebek's voice, and that turned out to be really important. The Jeopardy buzzer is tricky, and figuring out mm-hmm. the timing is tricky. And the funny thing is, you know, I was terrified when I was asked to guest host and later host the show, but it turned out to be the same preparation. I would just go back and watch tape of Alex, because he was so perfect for that job, and he had 38 years to perfect it. It just had an easy grace about him. And I realized, you know, if I just watch how he did it, I'm never going to be him, but I can't go that far wrong. So it was really kind of the same preparation.
Do you have a favorite moment from your time on the show or even your time as host now?
The funny thing is, it's been 20 years, but nothing beats that first game. Mm. You know, winning that first game, I was so terrified, and I see it now as a host. The contestants, it's a very intense experience. And so many of them they're really going through something up there. You know, they've got jitters at best. Sometimes they're really kind of having an out of body experience. You're in a fugue state up there. The game moves so fast, and everything's so unexpected. And I knew that going in that it was going to be stressful. And I thought, you know what? I just don't want to be the person who's negative going into Final Jeopardy and gets booted early. You know, I always felt bad for those people.
Yeah.
So my one dream was to not get, you know, kicked out during the third commercial.
Setting the bar low there.
Exactly. But I think that's realistic because you don't know what you're going to face out there. It's a tough climb. And so when I unexpectedly won that first game, I just remember this wave of like relief washing over me. Like, you know what? I'm a Jeopardy champion now, you know, for the rest of my life. I get to drop that into conversations. And the funny thing is now, you know, even after winning 73 more times or winning a tournament or being asked to host the show, you know, these are all remarkable honors, but nothing's as good as the relief of, hey, I just won a game of my favorite show. This is amazing.
Yeah.
And that GOAT trophy, by the way, the greatest
you liked
of all
that
time.
Trophy.
I love that trophy. It's like the best.
I have it at home. They wouldn't give it to me after the game. They were afraid that somebody, when I was flying home, somebody at TSA would see it and realize that I had won, and it would leak out, you know, early because the games weren't going to air for another week or two. So I was not allowed to take the trophy home because Jeopardy doesn't trust TSA.
All right, I got to give you one more question before we go to break, because of course I was asking myself this as I was reading the book. Ken, what do you think happens to us after we die?
You know, I'm ready for anything. And I'm
that's a cop out. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I'll give it to you.
I mean, let me say, like, it's the most obvious point, but there's really no evidence for any of these stories. You know, maybe nothing is the most likely option by Occam's razor. I know what I would personally like, which is answers. There's really not a lot of records of a heaven where it's spent learning all the knowledge that evaded you in life, you know, like
that is a trivia nerd's answer right there, Ken Jennings.
But it's not always trivia. It might be like, what were those people yelling at the airport that one time? Or, you know, what happened to Amelia Earhart? What killed the dinosaurs? Which girls actually liked me in fourth grade? You know, you never know these things. And maybe God would tell us if we asked.
Omniscience. Interesting. Well, Ken Jennings, you're actually sticking with us through the break, which we're going to take right now as we listen to Just Like Heaven by The Cure on Studio 2.
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Studio 2. I am Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And this is Trivia Thursday. You know I love to say that. And Ken Jennings is still here, and he's agreed to be our trivia contestant. Ken, we're
sport.
So excited to have you here.
It's been a while since I've been a contestant. I might be a little rusty.
But quick question before Avi, our quiz master, lays out his question. Can we expect to see you, you know, hosting this season? I know there's this writer's strike, but will you still be hosting with all this going on?
Yeah, the strike has really upended our plans for the season. We had very elaborate plans, and now we're kind of going to have to run in place with reused contestants and redeployed material. I'm working with Jeopardy right now on that scheduling, and you'll know when I know. Stay tuned.
All right.
Well, right now, and I know, look, Ken, you've won a lot of money playing trivia contests, I believe over $4 million, but you've never won the most prized most prized award in all of midday public radio trivia, which is a Studio 2 grocery tote bag. Which you can secure if you get this question. Get this question right. I'm also going to say before I ask you this, Ken, if this question is extremely easy for you, just please pretend it's hard, okay?
Pretty please.
If this is Philly trivia, it better be about Rocky, or it's not going to be easy.
Okay.
No, it's not about Rocky. All right, here's the question. Philadelphia's Fleer Corporation invented Double Bubble, the first commercially successful bubble gum, right here in Philadelphia. Fleer was also well known for producing what other non-candy product?
Fleer. Do I have to answer in the form of a question?
If you want to.
I'm going to say, if I'm remembering my childhood right, what are baseball cards?
That is correct!
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Baseball and trading cards. And in fact, the backstory is for a while, they could only sort of tread lightly in the baseball card world because Topps had this exclusive arrangement with MLB. But then there was this big antitrust case in the 70s and 80s that broke the market open for Fleer. So there you go. Ken Jennings, you are a Studio 2 trivia champion. Add that to your resume.
Gum and baseball cards. My childhood is paying off again.
Yes, and it's not a goat trophy, but that tote bag is pretty nice.
Feel free to tweet it out if you'd like.
I will use it to carry my trophy around.
Awesome. Thank you so much,
Ken
Jennings. Now, if you want to be the next Studio 2 trivia contestant and follow in Ken's footsteps, you can leave us a message at 215-351-0525. And the producers, they'll call you back. And if you're selected, we'll let you know. Tanya Pendleton's.
And Ken, we just wanted to thank you for being on the show and for joining us on Studio 2.
It was such a pleasure. I had a great time.
So Ken's new book, by the way, is 100 Places to See After You Die, a Travel Guide to the Afterlife. And after that, what do we got?
We got Tanya Pendleton's list of things to do. Sorry about that, kid.
Here it is. Hit it, Adam.
We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of hip-hop this year. Legend has it that when DJ Kool Herc threw a block party for his sister on August 11th, 1973, in front of 1520 Sedgwick Avenue in the Bronx, he started the global phenomenon. The celebration starts in Philly with DJ Cash Money and DJ Active at The Man at 8 p.m. on Thursday.
Everybody put your hands up in the air for Cash Money.
They're headlining Philly Pillars and Pioneers, Chill Moody's latest Downstage at the Man, a series that celebrates hip-hop. Other events are also happening around the city. Hip-hop ambassador Tame Arts is hosting his second annual Hip-Hop in the Park event on Saturday from noon to 8 p.m. at the Oval. It's free with an RSVP. And at Francisville Playground, the four elements of hip-hop, DJing, b-boying, emceeing, and graffiti art will be on display also on Saturday and also free. The Elements of Hip Hop 2023 goes from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. and we'll have all the details on our website, whyy.org/things to do. They're antique and they're classic. They're fast and they're furious. Those are the kind of cars you'll see at the 2023 New Hope Automobile Show. The show takes place on Saturday, August 12th and Sunday, August 13th. On Saturday, domestic cars, motorcycles, and professional vehicles will be on display, from some of the first vehicles in production to contemporary models. On Sunday, it's all foreign cars, including Ferraris, Maseratis, Porsches, and Rolls Royces. The show takes place at New Hope Soulbury High School from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. each day. It's a Bug's Life at the Bug Fest. The weekend festival is happening at the Academy of Natural Sciences on Saturday and Sunday. The fest is free with regular museum admission. The daily programming includes the ever-popular roach races, special exhibits and demonstrations, and a chance to meet and chat with entomologists. While insects are essential to our ecosystem, sometimes they're dangerous. A film screening event in Delaware explains the challenges of chronic Lyme disease, which is transmitted by tick bites.
Here's a disease that's affecting a lot of people, can be costly, and there's been a very active effort to define not Lyme disease away, but chronic Lyme disease away.
A special showing of the quiet epidemic at the screening room at 1313 in Wilmington will be followed by a Q&A on the impact of chronic Lyme disease and its controversial history. It's happening Friday, August 11th at 6 p.m. The event is free. The Philadelphia Obon Festival is held annually to honor the ancestors. In Japanese culture, August is the time people return to their hometowns to remember loved ones that have passed on. Traditional music and dance performances are part of the celebration that culminates in the Obon Lantern Ceremony next weekend. The free festival takes place on Saturday, August 12th at Shofuso Japanese Cultural Center in Fairmont Park. It goes from 2 to 7 p.m. Go, 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 shawty. It's your birthday. We're going to party like it's your birthday. We started out this week's Things to Do acknowledging hip-hop's 50th anniversary. This weekend, we have two of its pioneering superstars in town. 50 Cent and Busta Rhymes are headed to the Freedom Mortgage Pavilion in Camden on Saturday. 50 is celebrating the 20-year anniversary of his hit album Get Rich or Die Trying. Looks like that worked out for him. The show starts at 7 p.m. We never knew rap would take it this far, but it did thanks to those artists and many more. Happy birthday, hip-hop. And that's it for this week's Things to Do. It's been fun, but time for us to go. We'll be back next Thursday with more weekend options. If you want to hear details and info on even more events, head to our website, whyy.org/things to do. Whatever you choose to do, have a great weekend, everyone.
Boom, boom. Boom, boom. Everyone knows that beat.
I know. And tomorrow is the actual 50th anniversary of hip-hop.
Happy 50th hip-hop.
I know. This has been a big week. We had the president of the Philadelphia
Federal Reserve Bank.
Yep. Here. I mean, we talked. We had our Eric Thomas on talking about his new book. We had Ken Jennings on.
Yeah, Ken Jennings on. It was a fun week of studio, yes. Too. I actually wanted to mention one thing that we didn't talk to Ken about in the book. That I found so fascinating. Mm-hmm. The percentage of Americans who believe in God or participate in formal religion has declined significantly since the 1970s. The percent who believe in the afterlife has actually increased.
Wow.
We can't shake that. There has to be something beyond this. even if, you know, our adherence to dogmatic religion starts to waver. I found that so fascinating. And it makes you want to read the whole book.
Yeah. And thanks so much to Ken Jennings. Again, his book, 100 Places to See After You Die. And that wraps up our show for today. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Adam Staniszewski is our engineer. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. For more of our show, you can head on over to WHYY.org/studio2. Or download it wherever you get your pods. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly, I'm Cherry Gregg.
My name is Avi Lil Wolfie Wolfman Arendt. Thank you for joining us.